Hello, ladies and gentlemen. This is Dan Trotter, Pretty Good Bible Studies. In this audio, I will cover Genesis chapter 23, verses 1 through 20, the entire chapter, which covers Sarah's death and burial. Our context is this. In the previous chapter, we saw Abraham virtually sacrifice Isaac on Mount Moriah. And, of course, the ram was provided as a substitute sacrifice, perfect type of Christ. So we start in verse 1, Genesis 23. Now Sarah lived 127 years. These were the years of the life of Sarah. And she's going to die at age 127. Abraham lived 125. Sarah was 10 years younger than Abraham. Now, it is speculated. People don't know exactly how old Isaac was when he went up on Mount Moriah with Abraham, but let's say he was 15 or 20. So that means that Isaac is about 36 years old when Sarah dies, because we know that Sarah was 90 when Isaac was born. She died at 127. You do the math, and Isaac is now 36, 37 years old. So we'll assume 10, 15 years later after our previous chapter when Isaac was taken up on Mount Moriah, some 15, 20 years have passed. We will assume that Abraham is still at Beersheba, although it's not certain. So that's our context, where we are now. Jameson, Fawcett, Brown, Gill, and Clark all say that Sarah is the only woman in Scripture whose age, death, and burial is given when she died, because she's a very important mother of all nations. She was made a type of the Church of Christ. Famous allegory. In fact, I think it's the only allegory in the New Testament Paul gave to the Galatians in Galatians 4, verses 22 through 26. For it is written that Abraham had two sons, one by a slave and the other by a free woman. The slave is Hagar, the free woman is Sarah. But the one by the slave, Hagar, was born as a result of the flesh, because Hagar was not of the legal lineage. She was a concubine. She wasn't the primary wife of Abraham. And she was born of the flesh because they decided to fulfill God's promise, not the way God wanted to, but by the way they wanted to. And so she was born as a result of the flesh. While the one by the free woman was born through promise. That's the promise to Abraham, the famous land offspring and blessing promises. And Isaac was born by that free woman, Sarah. These things are being taken figuratively, for the women represent two covenants. One is from Mount Sinai and bears children into slavery. That's Hagar. That's the flesh. Mount Sinai, law, flesh, death. Now, Hagar represents Mount Sinai in Arabia and corresponds to the present Jerusalem, which, of course, is the Jerusalem that killed Jesus and was all into legalism and such. For she is in slavery with her children. So Paul is saying the Jews are slaves. And they're like Hagar. They're like Ishmael, born of the flesh, slavery. But the Jerusalem above is free, and she is our mother. And of course, the Jerusalem above is the symbol for the church, and she is our mother. So the church is our mother. And of course, the Jerusalem above is likened in this passage to Sarah, the woman born through promise. So Sarah is a type of the Church of Christ. She is celebrated in the New Testament for her faith. In Hebrews 11:11, we read this. By faith, even Sarah herself received ability to conceive, even beyond the proper time of life, since she considered him faithful who had promised. So not only Abraham had faith to have that promised son, but so did Sarah. Sarah is praised in the New Testament for her obedience. 1 Peter 3:6, just as Sarah obeyed Abraham, calling him Lord, you have become her children when you do what is good and do not fear any intimidation. So Sarah becomes the exemplar of the obedient wife, and Sarah had to obey Abraham when Abraham said, go into the Pharaoh's and Abimelech of Gerar's harem, Sarah, it'll be okay. That takes a lot of obedience. So Sarah was quite a woman. She was also very beautiful physically, because she attracted the eyes of these kings, the Pharaoh and Abimelech of Gerar. So she died after living a very fruitful life. We go to verse 2 in Genesis 23. Sarah died in Kiriath Arba, that is Hebron, in the land of Canaan, and Abraham went to mourn for Sarah and to weep for her. Now, Hebron is about, 24, 25 miles south of Jerusalem. If you look at the north end of the Dead Sea, which is about where Jerusalem is, and go down about a third of the way down on the west coast, that's Hebron. The original name of Hebron was Kiriath Arba. Now, it is speculated that the reason Sarah died in Hebron and not in Beersheba, where Abraham probably was, which is another 24, 25 miles south, and at the top of the bottom third of the Dead Sea, to the west of the Dead Sea, on a straight line, Jerusalem, Hebron, and Beersheba. But Sarah wasn't in Beersheba when she died. She was in Hebron. So the speculation is that Abraham was wandering around with his flocks looking for pasture and just happened to be in Hebron when Sarah died. Now, Kiriath Arba, Kiriath is the Hebrew for city. Arba is a person's name. So, as Easton's Illustrated Dictionary says, city of Arba, Kiriath Arba, city of Arba, the original name of Hebron, so called from the name of its founder, one of the Anakim. So Arba was the, as we'll see later, Arba was the father of Anak, and Anak is the ancestor of the famous Anakim, the giants. Kiriath Arba was given to Caleb. Hebron was given to Caleb by Joshua as his portion. The Jews interpret the name as meaning the city of the four, which it can sometimes be translated that way. The city of the four, and I've seen several speculations on a Jewish website as what city of the four might mean. Easton said that the city of the four meant Abraham, Isaac, Jacob, and Adam were all buried there, they say, the Jews say. Of course, Adam buried there, I don't think so. Now, Kiriath Arba, also known as Hebron, is also known as Mamre, Genesis 35:27. Jacob came to his father Isaac at Mamre of Kiriath Arba, that is Hebron. So just put all those things together. Originally, it was called the Oak at Mamre, or the Oak of Mamre. Mamre was one of Abraham's Amorite allies when he went to fight the Mesopotamian alliance led by Chedorlaomer of Elam. So just associate those names in your mind. Mamre, Kiriath Arba, Hebron. Now, as I said, Arba was the father, Kiriath Arba, the city of Arba. Arba was the father of Anak. Anak is the ancestor of the famous race of giants in Canaan, in the land there. Anakim most likely means long-necked, as gotquestions.org says. The Hebrews thought them to be descendants of the Nephilim, who were the pre-flood giants we read about in Genesis 6. There were also aboriginal giants in the land called Rephaim, and people love to get into this. What's the relationship of the Nephilim with the Rephaim and the Anakim? Well, let me give you two opinions as to how the Rephaim are related to the Nephilim. Here's a quotation from IsraelAHistoryOf.com that says this, quote, though the Rephaim are never mentioned directly in the same breath as the Nephilim, they are directly connected to the Anakim, whom are connected with the Nephilim. Steve Quayle has conducted much research on the topic and claims the two were cousins or shared some sort of blood relation. By extension, thus, the Rephaim were also distant descendants of the Nephilim. So this website connects the Anakim, the Rephaim, and the Nephilim all together as giants. On the other hand, if you look at BibleStudyTools.com, the dictionary there, the Rephaim were not necessarily connected with the giants. In other words, it's controverted. I don't really care. I just thought I'd bring that up since there seems to be a cottage industry in Nephilim research these days. So for our purposes, we'll just summarize all that and say that the Nephilim were pre-flood giants and the Anakim and the Rephaim were post-flood giants living in Canaan. And by the way, the Rephaim had different names. The Ammonites call them the Zamzumin and the Moabites call them the Emin, same people. How they related to the Anakim, I'm not exactly sure. And how they related to the Nephilim, I'm not exactly sure. But just you hear those names, Nephilim, Rephaim, and Anakim, think giants. And the Anakim were headquartered right there at Hebron. As I mentioned, the town can also mean the town of four. I mentioned that the four were have different speculations as to what the four referred to. In Joshua 15:13-14, we read this, now it gave to Caleb, the son of Jephunneh, a portion among the sons of Judah, according to the command of the Lord to Joshua, namely Kiriath Arba, that's Hebron, Arba being the father of Anak, and that's how we know that the Anakim are from Hebron. Caleb drove out from there the three sons of Anak, Sheshai, Ahiman, and Talmai, the children of Anak. So city of the four could mean Anak, Sheshai, Ahiman, and Talmai. Well, all that's nice speculation. I don't know. At any rate, Sarah is buried in the land of the giants, in the land of the Anakim. In verse 2, Genesis 23, Abraham is said to go in to mourn for Sarah. Abraham went in to mourn for Sarah. Went, some speculate that he went from Beersheba to Hebron, which is about 24 miles north of Beersheba. Hebron is about 24 miles north of Beersheba, as Adam Clark said, and so that might be why Abraham went up there. Or he could have been there in Hebron when Sarah died. Who knows? We move now to Genesis 23, verses 3 and 4. Then Abraham got up from beside his dead wife and spoke to the Hethites. The Hethites are the sons of Heth, or the Hittites, as we more commonly know them. I am an alien residing among you. Give me burial property among you so that I can bury my dead. The NIV translates that as Hittites. Holman Christian Study Bible translates it as Hethites. The New American Standard Bible translates it as the sons of Heth. Now, who are these Hittites? They're very famous in ancient history, so we're going to spend some time on them. They were a powerful people centered in Asia Minor, present-day Turkey. They dominated much of Canaan. So you look at Turkey, Anatolia, and then you curl on down through Syria and down to Lebanon and down through Israel. That's where the Hittites, at various times in their history, made their stomping grounds. Rough dates for when they were a powerful empire, 1800 BC to 1200 BC. Now, Abraham here is about at the end of the 19th century, 1800, 1825, 1800, around there. So this is right around when the Hittites got started as an empire. Let me read some of the entry of Easton's Illustrated Dictionary concerning the Hittites. They inhabited the whole region between the Euphrates and Damascus, that's in Syria, their chief cities being Carchemish on the Euphrates, also in Syria, and Kadesh in the Orontes Valley as you go down to Syria toward Lebanon. That's the place of a very famous battle between Ramses II and the Hittites, because it's about the only battle that's carved on the monuments down there in Egypt. And so that's why we know a lot about that famous battle at Kadesh. These Hittites seem to have risen to great power as a nation, as for a long time they were formidable rivals of the Egyptian and Assyrian empires. In the book of Joshua, they always appear as the dominant race to the north of Galilee. They are first referred to in Scripture in the history of Abraham, who brought from Ephron the Hittite the field in the cave of Machpelah. That's what we're looking at now in Genesis 23. That's their first mentioned. Esau took his first two wives from the Hittites. They are afterwards mentioned in the usual way among the inhabitants of the promised lands. You have the Girgashites and the Jebusites and the Canaanites and the Amorites and the Hittites. So they're there. They were closely allied to the Amorites and are frequently mentioned along with them as inhabiting the mountains of Palestine. When the spies entered the land, they seemed to have occupied with the Amorites the mountain region of Judah. They took part with the other Canaanites against the Israelites. And after that, there are a few references to them in Scripture. We have Ahimelech the Hittite in 1 Samuel 26 and the famous Uriah the Hittite, one of David's chief officers that David murdered, 2 Samuel 23. In the days of Solomon, they were a powerful confederation in the north of Syria, which is typically their area. They've been that way for years. They were ruled by kings north of Syria. They are met with after the exile, after 586 BC, still as a distinct people in Ezra 9. The Hebrew merchants exported horses from Egypt, not only for the kings of Israel, but also for the Hittites. So they hung around for a long time, even after the exile, but not as a big empire. That kind of died out in 1200 BC. By the time you get past 586 BC, they're just still around, but they're not organized into a big empire. From the Egyptian monuments, we learned that the Hittites were a people with yellow skins and mongoloid features. In other words, look like Chinese people. The Amorites were, well, we don't need to worry about the Amorites. All right. The original seat of the Hittite tribes was the mountain ranges of Taurus. The Taurus Mountains run right through Taurus, is where Paul, the Apostle Paul, was born, and they kind of make a C. They run west to east, and then right as the Mediterranean Sea ends, they turn up north and create a barrier between the eastern end of Turkey and Syria and the western end of Turkey. And that's where the Hittites were. Just remember, Hittites, Anatolia, present-day Turkey, and also in present-day Lebanon, present-day Israel. That's kind of their stomping grounds in Syria. Abraham rose in verse 3 after he sat in grief next to his wife. He was mourning, sitting next to his dead wife, and then he rose up. That was the custom, to sit in grief next to your dead beloved one. He announces to the Hittites, I am an alien residing among you. Alien is the Holman Christian Study Bible translation. Other translations have it stranger and a sojourner. That's the New American Standard. The NIV has an alien and a stranger. The idea of the patriarchs being an alien, a stranger, a sojourner is everywhere in the Scriptures. For example, we see David speaking in 1 Chronicles 29:15, for we are sojourners before you and tenants, as all our fathers were. Our days on the earth are like a shadow, and there is no hope. Psalm 39:12, this is David speaking again. He says, hear my prayer, O Lord, and give ear to my cry. Do not be silent at my tears, for I am a stranger with you, a sojourner like all my fathers, not having a home. Hebrews 11:13, all these died in faith without receiving the promises, but having seen them and having welcomed them from a distance and having confessed that they were strangers and exiles on the earth. 1 Peter 2:11, beloved, I urge you as aliens and strangers to abstain from fleshly lust which wage war against the soul. Now the application here is very obvious. We cannot make our home here on this earth. It's just a temporary place. Our life here is passing away. It's like a flash. In a microsecond, it's gone. You can pile up money and land here all you want and try to get comfortable. You'll never be comfortable because this place was not meant to be our home. And, of course, the type of that is Abraham wandering around in the promised land. It was promised to him, but he was a stranger and a pilgrim and a sojourner there. His citizenship was rather in heaven, not in Israel, not in the promised land. Now, why does Abraham want to bury Sarah somewhere? Why does he want burial property to purchase from the Hittites? Probably because at that time it was very ignominious to bury someone in the tombs of strangers. You needed your own family tomb. The Hittites offered Abraham a tomb for free, although at least ostensibly for free, but Abraham refused that because he didn't want to bury his wife in the home of a pagan, in the tomb of a pagan. He wanted his own tomb. Now you ask yourself, why did Abraham not have any land of himself? Well, because he was a pilgrim. It had prevented him from acquiring any land. He had to wander with his flocks, and so it didn't make economic sense. I'm sure he could have afforded it because he was rich, but he probably didn't want to be tied down. He had to be a nomad because of his flocks. We go now to Genesis 23, verses 5 through 9. The sons of Heth, the Hittites, answered Abraham, saying to him, "Hear us, my lord. You are a mighty prince among us. Bury your dead in the choicest of our graves. None of us will refuse you his grave for burying your dead." So Abraham rose and bowed to the people of the land, the sons of Heth, the Hittites. And he spoke with them, saying, "If it is your wish for me to bury my dead out of my sight, hear me and approach Ephron, the son of Zohar, for me, that he may give me the cave of Machpelah, which he owns, which is at the end of his field. For the full price, let him give it to me in your presence for a burial site." Now notice how respectful everybody is in this transaction. First of all, the Hittites answered Abraham, "Hear us, mighty prince." Call him mighty prince. "Then you, Abraham, was loaded. They wanted to be on his good side." So they speak very respectfully to him. The Hittites say, "None of us Hittites will refuse you his grave for burying your dead." His grave, in other words, they'll give you a place to bury Abraham. But of course, as we said earlier, Abraham didn't want a free grave because it would mean he had to be buried amongst the heathen. You notice here Abraham rose and bowed. So the Hittites were formally polite to Abraham. Abraham rose back up and bowed to the Hittites. He was being very polite. He was sitting by Sarah when the Hittites came in. He stood up and asked the Hittites for land. He probably sat back down, and now he rose back up again waiting for a reply. Now Abraham asked the Hittites to approach one of their own, Ephron, the son of Zohar. Abraham could have done it himself, but why did he not want to do that? He probably felt it would not be likely that Ephron would sell to him if Abraham individually approached Ephron. But if the elders of the Hittites there in Hebron, if they approached Ephron, that might have more weight with Ephron. So that's why he asked the Hittites to do it for him. Abraham wants to buy the cave of Machpelah, which is at the end of Ephron's field. Machpelah means double cave in Hebrew. According to tradition, there's a large cave at Hebron containing the graves of the patriarchs. There's still a nice tourist site there. I haven't been there, but you can look on Wikipedia and see the grave sites everywhere. Tradition, here's who was buried, some tradition and some scripture, but this is who the Jews say are buried there: Abraham and Sarah, Isaac and Rebekah, Jacob and Leah. The cave of Machpelah, according to tradition, is under the Mosque of Abraham, which is a Muslim shrine. Now, why did Abraham say in verse 9 that he would pay the full price to Ephron for that burial plot, that burial cave? Because, in my opinion, Abraham didn't want to be under obligation to pagans, so he says, "I'll pay you the full price." We go now to Genesis 23:10-11. Now, Ephron was sitting among the sons of Heth, and Ephron the Hittite answered Abraham in the hearing of the sons of Heth, even of all who went at the gate of his city, saying, "No, my lord, hear me. I give you the field. I give you the cave that is in it. In the presence of the sons of my people, I give it to you. Bury your dead." Well, that's very magnanimous. It says that Ephron answered Abraham. I assume that the Hittites went to Ephron. Ephron answered the Hittites. Abraham wasn't actually there hearing this. Well, he was there hearing this because they said, "No, my Lord, hear me, I give you the field." So somehow the Hittites introduced Abraham to Ephron, and Ephron was very amenable to the proposition. In fact, he said, 3 times, "I'm going to give it to you." Where did this happen? It happened in the gate of the city of Hebron. The gate is where all legal and public matters are transacted. You see this all through the scriptures. Now, Ephron said 3 times he was going to give that field to Abraham. This is to emphasize that the field was freely given. Ah, that sounds so charitable. But this was only a show. He expected costly presents in return, as Jameson, Fawcett, and Brown said. And Abraham knew this, and so he offered a price. So this was a lot of Oriental culture here going on. Now, why did Abraham only want the end of the field instead of the whole field? Well, owning the whole tract would have subjected Abraham to extra obligations, both financial and social. He would have been a part of Hittite culture, both legally and socially. So he didn't want to do that. The NIV Study Bible says that Hittite law said that when a small tract was sold, the original parcel owner owed dues, in other words, taxes, if you will, to the government. But if you just sell a little piece off, the person that owns the little piece is free from these obligations. So Abraham didn't want to get involved with the Hittites too much. He just wanted the end of the field, Machpelah. We go down to Genesis 23, verses 12 through 15. And Abraham bowed before the people of the land, still being very polite. He spoke to Ephron in the hearing of the people of the land, saying, "If you will only please listen to me, I will give the price of the field. Accept it from me, that I may bury my dead there." Then Ephron answered Abraham, saying to him, "My lord, listen to me. A piece of land worth 400 shekels of silver, what is that between me and you? So bury your dead," which is the very polite and fancy way of saying, "I'm going to charge you 400 shekels of silver for this land." Now, 400 shekels of silver is an exorbitant price, as the NIV Study Bible says. It's about 10 pounds of silver, says the note there. 10 pounds of silver. That's not negligible. So we could say that Ephron is taking advantage of Abraham here during his time of grief and bereavement. Notice he starts out pricing the land for free. I'll give it to you. Oh, well, how about 400 shekels, which is an arm and a leg. And the way of saying it, what is that between me and you? That's just Oriental civility, Arab civility. He never was intending to give that field away. He was planning on selling it, and that's what they do. We go to Genesis 23, verses 16 through 20, and we'll finish up this audio. Abraham listened to Ephron, and Abraham weighed out for Ephron the silver which he had named in the hearing of the sons of Heth, the Hittites, 400 shekels of silver, commercial standard. So Ephron's field, which was in Machpelah, which faced Mamre, the field and cave which was in it, and all the trees which were in the field that were within all the confines of its border, were deeded over to Abraham for a possession in the presence of the sons of Heth, the Hittites, before all who went into the gate of his city. After this, Abraham buried Sarah, his wife, in the cave of the field at Machpelah, facing Mamre, that is Hebron, in the land of Canaan. Might as well put Machpelah in there as something to associate with Hebron. So the field and the cave that is in it were deeded over to Abraham for a burial site by the sons of Heth. It's interesting, even in English law, American law, you deed land over it. Any cave that's on it, any field that's on it, any trees that are on it, it all goes with the land, including all buildings that were on it too, for that matter. That didn't apply in this case, but that's very typical. Everything that's attached to the land goes with the land in a deed. 400 shekels of silver, Abraham paid commercial standard. That was contrasted with the king's standard. We see the king's standard mentioned in 2 Samuel 14:26, when he, that's Absalom, cut the hair of his head, David's son Absalom. It was at the end of every year that he cut it, for it was heavy on him, so he cut it. He weighed the hair of his head at 200 shekels by the king's weight. The king standardized the weight of a shekel so it would help commerce. Commercial standard, it didn't. That's a minor detail. It's kind of interesting, though. The exact price of that field is named. The silver was weighed out by weight. There was no coinage yet. We don't have coinage till the 7th century B.C. And I think, Croesus that invented that, if I remember correctly? Croesus of Lydia. Now, this field that Abraham bought, this is the first time he's bought anything permanent in the Promised Land. It was a pledge, a down payment, for the future possession of all Canaan for his descendants, which is exactly what happened. From the River Euphrates to the Wadi El Arish, the border of Egypt, the descendants of Abraham owned all of Canaan. That was a long time from now, about 800 years or so. Now, this is interesting. Abraham was wandering all around the Promised Land. He was wandering on other people's lands. This is what Adam Clark says, quote, Abraham, being only a sojourner in that land, shifting from place to place for the mere purpose of pasturing his flocks, and having no right to any part of the land, wished to purchase a place in which he might have the continual right of sepulture, whatever that means, sepulture, continual right of burying his dead, that's what it means, it's old English. So that raises a question in my mind, what is the custom in the ancient Near East of people who are nomads but don't own land? Can they just wander around and chomp on other people's grass, people who do own the land, or did nobody own the land, like the West in America in the 19th century, or like the nomads on the steppes in Central Asia? I don't know. My guess is that nobody owned the land and everybody wandered and got the grass with it when they could get it, and whoever got there first had the right to eat the grass. Now, Adam Clark's got an interesting quote to talk about this deeding ceremony. I've already mentioned how polite it was and how civil it was. This is what Clark says about it, quote, "There is neither awkward, stiff formality on the one hand," I don't know about that, it seems kind of stiff to me, but not according to Clark, "there's neither stiff formality nor frippery or affectation on the other hand. Decent respect, good sense, good nature, and good breeding are all prominently displayed. And how highly laudable and useful is all this? A pedant or a bore on either side might have destroyed the simplicity of the whole transaction, the one by engendering caution and suspicion, and the other by exciting disgust. In all such transactions, the beau and the boor are equally to be avoided." The beau, I guess, is the fop. The dandy and the boor, we know what a boor is. Well, that's some highfalutin rhetoric by Adam Clark to talk about a legal transaction. But let's sum up this chapter by pointing out that in the ancient Near Eastern culture, one desired strongly to be buried with one's fathers. That was a big deal. By buying a burial place in Canaan, Abraham showed where his home was. This showed an unswerving commitment to God's promise to him. As according to the NIV Study Bible, remember the promises, land, offspring, and blessing. The land was part of the promise. We can see this also when Jacob insisted to Joseph to get his bones carried from Egypt to Israel after Jacob died in captivity or in exile in Egypt. He wanted his bones carried to Israel because that's where he wanted to be buried. And so, ladies and gentlemen, we are finished with this chapter. A good application is we need to have our home in the new Israel, not the old Israel, not the physical Israel, but the new Israel, which is the church. That's what needs to center us. That's where we need to die. The church needs to be our mother, not this world. Ladies and gentlemen, I have finished Genesis chapter 23, verses 1 through 20, the whole chapter concerning Sarah's death and burial. We are now prepared to move to chapter 24. In our next audio, we'll do the first 20 verses. Eliezer, or Abraham's servant, who we think is Eliezer, he's going to find Rebekah because he's looking for a wife for his son, Isaac. I hope you stay tuned for that audio, and I hope you enjoyed this one.